Enrollment is open for Thomas's upcoming six-session live online course, Navigating the Levels of Trauma Healing. Explore how to work with the impacts of collective crises and challenges, and learn tools to manage anxiety, overwhelm, and nervous system dysregulation during times of accelerated change and disruption. In this all-new curriculum, Thomas and expert guest speakers will engage in ecosystemic practices to collectively explore our resilience, agency, and capacity to stay present and find deeper meaning. Click the link in our show notes to learn more and enroll, or go to www.navigatingthelevelsoftrauma.com. Welcome to Point of Relation with Thomas Hubel, a podcast that illuminates the path to collective healing at the intersection of science and mysticism. In his conversations with visionaries, innovators, artists, and healers, Thomas invites guests into a relational experience that allows inspiration and innovation to emerge. This is the Point of Relation. The following interview was recorded during a previous Collective Trauma Summit, an online gathering convened annually by Thomas Hubel to share ideas and inspire action for healing, individual, ancestral, and collective trauma. Visit CollectiveTraumaSummit.com to listen to featured talks from our most recent summit and sign up to be the first to know when the next summit is announced. Zenju Earthlyn Manuel, PhD, is a poet, author, and Zen Buddhist priest. The essence of all her transmissions comes together in her teachings and books. Her work has been featured in Essence Magazine, CNN, CBS News, On Being, Buddha Dharma, and Lion's Roar. She holds an MA from UCLA and a PhD in transformative learning from California Institute of Integral Studies. She formerly worked for decades in social science research, philanthropy with major foundations, director for nonprofit organizations including those serving women and girls, cultural arts, education, and mental health.
Hello and welcome back to the Collective Trauma Summit. My name is Thomas Hubel. I'm the convener of the summit, and I'm very happy and delighted and very curious to sit here with poet and author and Buddhist priest Zenju Earthlyn Manuel. So Zenju, a very warm welcome, and I'm so happy and I'm very curious to have our conversation today. So very warm welcome here.
All right. Thank you, Thomas, for inviting me. And I'm very excited about the conversation with you. And before we begin, I want to honor all those who have come before me, who are the reason why I sit here before you. I want to honor all the teachers, sages, and prophets that have taught me and have walked with me, and all of those unseen spirits of the various elements that have been with me, those of the fire, the earth, and the water. And I want to give thanks and honor, at least, the spirits of the indigenous, Native American indigenous, who were the caretakers of this land, who are still here taking care of much of the land, but not all of the land. And so I want to honor what has happened in on this land to their people, and bring the understanding that we have yet to cede the land back. And so I just wanted to make that clear. So all of that I speak with, all of this I honor, and I'm grateful for those who walk the path that you walk, Thomas, who walk the path of spirit. Thank you.
Oh, that's so beautiful. It's so soothing. It's so, like, there's something very true when I listen to you. It touches me also, how you bring in the deep honoring of tradition. I often call this, that's the one tradition, is the tradition of life, you know, the lights being passed on from generation to generation. And I am so, it's beautiful that you, you know, make such a dedicated space for that invocation and honoring. So thank you for that. It's beautiful. Beautiful. And I think especially in our often, you know, Western modern society, in the hyper individualized self, everything is around me and that what I'm going to do and around, but the recognition of the depth that lives in us. And that I think that that brings us already to the deeper matter of our conversation, is like that I believe often trauma creates that disconnect also within our ancestral lineage and between each other, and creates some kind of separation, sense of separation. Mm-hmm. And maybe before we go into the ancestral separation, maybe you want to share with us a little bit, since you devote your life deeply to the spiritual path, and that's something that's very close to me, and I'm always interested, you know, what was the initiating factor? Was that from the beginning, from day one like that? Was there something that happened for you that initiated you into the spiritual journey? And so maybe you can just speak to that a bit for us.
Yes, I think the largest and most potent incident, and earliest, I'll put it that way, incident that happened to me in my life was to lose a childhood friend at 6 years old. And I was amazed. I was shocked, actually, that I even wasn't sure if the story was true. I had to go back and ask my older sister, did I lose a friend at 6 years old? And she said, yes, you did. And she was someone I played with. You know, we rode our bikes up and down the block. She lived around the corner with her aunt. Her aunt was from either Texas or Louisiana, because the area had migrants from Louisiana, Black migrants from Louisiana and Texas lived in that area, because, you know, you just share places and work, you know, where to live and where to work when you come to a new state. And so this child, my friend, was living with her aunt. They hadn't been there long, but I really enjoyed the little girl's company. And so then when I heard that she died, you know, my mother was just like kind of talking, kind of like, yes, you know, she passed. And before she passed, she asked for you know, milk and honey. And I was like, I didn't understand any of that, you know, and I didn't understand how a child could die. And she hadn't lived her life. You know, that's all I could think of. And I actually, instead of being sad, I was angry. I was very angry. So I could say maybe my spiritual path was fueled by anger in some way. I was angry to find out that you come into life and they talk about how beautiful it is to be born, and then you find out you're not going to get to stay. And I got very angry at my mother for having given birth to me. She did not understand that. I was like, I wish you hadn't have done that. I wouldn't have to go through this. And I took it very personally. I was a child. And so it began a query, a quest to look at what was life and in what was death. And I would think about it a lot at night, you know, after experiencing the death of my friend, thinking about it. You know, I wasn't allowed to go to the funeral. I guess they thought I was too young. I did eventually go to one, begged, because I wanted to see death. I wanted to see what it looked like. And I finally did at 8 years old. It took 2 years to get my mother to take me to somebody's funeral. But I didn't get to go to hers, but I would ride to her house every day on my bike. And there would be a black wreath on the door. That's what they used to do in the old days, which I still think it's a wonderful ritual so that everyone knows that this house is in mourning, you know, and you know where to bring the food, find out if they need anything. And then at that time, too, people wore black bands at that time. Sometimes people do that every now and then in different places, but it gives you notice that this person's in sacred space. This house is in sacred space, and the people around them, their friends and their family, are in sacred space. So I can articulate that now, but as a child, I could not. I could not understand what was going on. So I really feel like that was the beginning of me saying, I'm going to walk this path of query. Really is what it was, in quest. And I think truly that's what the path of spirit or spirituality is walking with a quest, with an inquiry about this life, and discovering what is it, and that we're here for, or it didn't even have to be what we're here for, just what is it that this is? What is this flesh and bones? What is this that is born from a place we don't really know biologically, we could say, but where are we from? Where did you and I come from? And how did you and I come to be right here, right now, together? How? And how will, and where are you and I going when we drop the flesh and the body and the bones? We don't know. And I think that that's kind of the most gnawing thing for people. To not know. We have a lot of things I can tell you a whole lot of ideas I have, but we can share those, but we don't know. So that is still, that 6-year-old is still in the quest, still walking the query. She is, and she's been through a lot of things like, oh, why this, why that, why that? You know, what is this, what is that, what is that? And, you know, it's been a wonderful life, because I have had that innate kind of, you know, seeing life as some kind of, you know, amusement in some way. Mm-hmm. And it hurt too, you know, there was a lot of pain, but that too became part of the path of looking and seeing. And that's all it is. I think that's all we're here to do, personally. Mm-hmm.
Lovely, you're transmitting the curiosity and this joyful curiosity of your inquiry. You know, you're transmitting that as you speak. So that's very beautiful. It's like I'm looking into this face of your curiosity. That's lovely. It's beautiful. And so how did that influence, like you're deeply into Zen practice, but you're also deeply into like the shamanistic tradition.
Okay.
And so often we meet people, okay, they say, okay, I'm a Zen practitioner and that's what I practice and that's gonna be the practice. And I'm, because I'm also very interested in the mystical practice, and I think that there are different levels to contemplative practices. And I'm curious why you thought that the confluence of those two are important in your journey or for people that you teach. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about these two streams and how they support each other.
Okay. So first of all, every gateway that I have entered, no matter what that path is, when I met diviners from Dahomey at 18. When I went to church at 6, okay, everything to me was a gateway that I just would just walk in and go, you know, and then I would discover later I was someplace. but mostly something was driving me into the gateway of church and to the gate, because church to me was not something my parents pushed me into, although they did too push me into that at the same time. So they wanted me to have God so I would survive this life as a Black child. And then there was the, I think the next largest was the gateway of the Dahomey Diviners from Africa. I didn't know where I was really. When I entered Buddhism or the Dharma or Buddhist teachings, that was the same thing. I entered Nichiren tradition and I didn't know where I was. And I entered Zen and I really didn't know where I was. So all of these gateways, I would just enter because they were presented to me to enter. I didn't decide what they would do for me, what I would get out of it. Can I be a better person? Will I be, will miracles happen to me? I wasn't looking for anything, probably other than a place to cry. A place to cry, a place to pray, a place to be joined in those things, a place for joy, and a place for a healing together. I think we speak of that collective healing in action. That's collective healing in action. So I was used to being, to doing my healing in a collective way because of church. So, and pretty soon, you know, even my social justice gateway was in the gateway of spirituality and of collective healing. We didn't bother with any kind of social justice if it didn't have anything, if it didn't have anything to do with our healing, our transformation, our survival, not survival in the world materially, because we could do that with each other, but our survival and our dignity as human beings was the most important thing. It wasn't important that we get people to understand us, you know, to think better about us or any of those kinds of things. It was mostly just trying to, you know, understand our lives and live it fully. So I learned how to live it fully in a social justice movement based in the church, based in God. Mm-hmm. It was totally based in God. And it, that's the way it was. I mean, the movement, people came to the church to begin the movement, you know, at least in Los Angeles where I was raised. So it wasn't any other place but there at church in the basement where you fry chicken and you eat potato salad and you have chocolate cake and the places where you played and you met people from your from the back country, usually from where we're from, Louisiana or Texas, you know. So it was a really vibrant and spiritual movement. And when I say it, I mean social justice was a vibrant spiritual movement. And so I was always, I guess, the aspects of each gateway, I think, came together, I guess, like I said, at that place of being able to bring one's whole self physically, emotionally, you know, spiritually, you know, anything. You just, everything a human being is made up of can be brought to it. And if I saw in a gateway that I could bring my whole self, whether I got there and someone said no, it didn't matter. I still could see that the practice itself was something that you could come to, you know. And yes, I was disappointed in many of the spiritual communities. You know, if I looked on the outside, if I looked outside of what was being taught, which I did a lot, look outside of what was being taught in church, I didn't leave the church because they were teaching hell and brimstone. I did not. I left it because I could feel I had been there long enough. I had been there long enough. I was 17. I knew. And it was that it was time for me to go into another gateway that was being presented. Now, when do these gateways get presented? You never know. I was at a restaurant, a new African restaurant, and that's where I met the diviners. They started inviting me, you know, to ceremonies. So I think also where the gateways meet, gateways meet for me is in the ceremony. So when I just imagine for that moment, that ceremony with the diviners, it was so different than the ceremonies that were happening at church. Now we had communion, we sang, we pray. And then when I got there, they were drumming, they were dancing, doing all kinds of prostrations. And I didn't know who and what was happening. And I didn't ask for any explanations. I just kept doing and doing and doing until they decided, and I write about this story quite a bit, so some people know it, is they invited me to Dahomey, to Africa. They said, come back and take your throne, that you are a diviner. And I didn't know what they were talking about. I had no idea what they were talking about. Mm-hmm. And I didn't find out they were diviners till 20 years later. So when the gateways open, we don't already always know, but there is for me a feeling in my own body and heart that says, this is a place you can sit a while in life. You can sit in here and reflect and contemplate, ask questions, be yourself. Even if someone doesn't want you to be yourself, you can be yourself. I don't know who's talking to me, who's saying that. Because when someone doesn't want me to be myself, I don't care, because someone else said I could be myself. Not some person, but something in my own being that knows that. And so it's almost like I'm a being that already knows who's coming looking for home. And I think many of us do already know, and we're always just looking for home. And that home, meaning not one place, not one dogma, not one tradition, but that home and that place in which we feel, oh, this is sanctuary. This is where my spirit can be held. And I too can honor it, my spirit. And then I too can honor the spirit of others. And then I learned how to do that, even if others have no idea of honoring me. I learned really young, somewhere between 6 and 10, that people were not going to honor me just because. And even if I worked hard, they weren't going to honor me. So it didn't matter, you know, that the honor is not something that can be forced, that people don't understand. I knew they didn't understand. I remember when I ran into racism and I said, wow, Mom, don't they know I didn't do this to myself? I didn't make myself this color. They know that, right? You know, my mom was just shaking her head and crying. She had tears, you know, because she knew I had hit that place. And I just couldn't believe it. But I knew that it was a matter of not knowing, you know, some place of naive, not that they didn't know any Black people, that wasn't it, but something that was missing in the spirit of humanity. I knew it at that young of an age that it was something missing. And then I thought, well, that must be missing in me as well. And so I couldn't find that missing place in having preachers preach sermons or even Dharma talks or any of the things that we enjoy, books. I read a lot of books. I think it really came from the first time, maybe, you know, I did go to that funeral and they were singing and they were doing things, you know. My father was part of the ritual, and I'd never seen him part of one. And I asked my mother, why does Daddy have gloves on? You know, he had white gloves on. I didn't understand it. But, you know, and then I was just watching the whole thing, and I got up with everybody to go see the body. You know, it was all rich. I thought that was just fascinating to me. And when I got to the body, I got traumatized, a little bit freaked out. But not enough to not look, you know. And then I went home, you know. So I feel like the spirit walk, the walk on spirit, the path on spirit is all shamanic. It's all ceremony. And when we talk about it, that's when separation can begin. Not all the time, but it can begin, because each one of us will talk about it differently. An experience that we all are having in common, but we're going to talk about it differently. We may talk about it from psychological, sociological, social justice, from pure energy, integral energy, metaphysics. There's all kinds of ways to talk about it. But once we start talking about it with each other or trying to influence each other with our words about it, I think that's when sometimes the separation begins. And that's okay, because the ritual will bring us back together.
Mm-hmm.
The rich, totally a ritual will do it.
Beautiful. When you see now the ritual ceremony is, because during the summit, we're also exploring what are collective remedies.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you envision, or how did you experience, like, ritual and ceremony as collective remedies when we look at collective trauma?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can speak.
Yes, I think from participating with many spiritual communities, and in every spiritual community, something happens. Every single one that exists, and if it hasn't happened, you're not looking, but something is happening that disrupts, that is maybe horrifying, traumatizing to somebody. And I noticed that when that happens, when there's more talking, trying to talk it out and talk about it, I think that's, I'm not negating that that's not a good path. But if that talking and work is pulled out, maybe some kind of model or something, approach is pulled out without any kind of prep for what is about to happen, before the talk, before coming down, some type of pre, I call it, you know, spiritual prelude or something, you know, a prologue, something before that must come, so that the space is in the energy of that sacred space created before. So not even an action. So some people, I've seen some people, they might, who follow various traditions, might pour water. Some people offer incense. Some people, you know, sing a song. You know, all of these things are real important. But what I find is that part of the program is 3 minutes, and the talk is 3 hours, and it should be in reverse. The ritual should be 3 hours, and the talk 3 minutes, if talk at all.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't felt anything in the 3 hours, a way of just being together and understanding that experience, and trusting it, because I don't think we trust it. I think that's why we talk about it a lot. I'm including myself in this now. I'm not looking at us, but you know, we don't trust that sometimes. We don't trust ourselves to be in a place in which there's been disruption and trauma and trouble and chaos and woundedness. And oh my God, we're not trusting ourselves to be there. So we're really trying to explain, this is what's happening to me. So I think it's important to kind of reverse, doesn't have to be 3 hours, but reverse the length of time we do the sacred part of our coming together. And I know that's kind of scary because a lot of people aren't into a spiritual path, or they are not, you know, don't believe in any of it. And I just ask those people to respect for a moment what we're about to do by just holding space for us, you know, and witnessing. We need a witness that this has gone on. You can be the witness. You participate in that way. And you can be the listener, you know, to participate. You don't have to say, I'm doing this too, because we are not doing it. What we are doing is being it. And they don't know that because they're not engaged. They never engaged it. They're always on the outside looking in. And so I invite those people to stay on the outside and look in. It's okay. We need witnesses. We do. We need someone to say this happened, you know. And I think a lot of times we try to pull people in. And I'm really not one to proselytize anything, any tradition. You know, people talk about meditation. And I talk about meditation as that place, that sacred place created before you take action in your life, before you talk to the teacher, before you go to work, before you do any of these things that have words or action. And so that you are doing it under the influence. It's kind of like I tell people, taking an elixir, you know, everyone maybe had a drink or something. You feel different after you have a glass of wine than you did before. Well, that's what I'm talking about. Have your glass of sacredness, and you'll feel different when you get up and walk in the world. You know, you may even stumble if you get too much of it. It might blow your mind. But, you know, that I think is, sometimes missing. And we also think out the rituals too much too, as well. It's good to have a protocol. I believe in that too, because it's there. But if we get stuck and this is how it should go, then when the spirit even disrupts that, you know, like, oops, then we're lost. And I've seen that happen in Zen practice, because everything's pretty. So I've seen that. I've seen a Kokyo, this person who starts to chant and leads to chant and then has this wonderful, what we call an echo in the end, that to me, I kind of, what the Africans would do it with their foot. They would just nail that prayer into the, you know, some Africans, West Africans, not all, would nail that into the ground, into the earth. Well, in Zen, the echo nails that chanting. You know, we chant, 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 chant. And then we say, we have chanted the Heart Sutra, you know, for the benefit of all. It's nailing that chant into the earth, you know. And so you could say, really, I could do an echo right here in a moment, you know. Like, you know, you're chanting, and then, you know, you feel something. You know, the echo is, you know, I'm going to echo the essence. Echo is actually a Japanese word, and I'm using it as an English one right now. But you can echo the essence of that poem, that teaching. So I have chanted the heart of great perfect wisdom, and having chanted the, maybe you might Shosho Samyo Kichijo Dharani, we dedicate this merit to all of those who are suffering, who are dying right now in COVID, who are, you know, trying to make a life after COVID. You can add what you want, you know, who have died in the streets. You can add what you want, what comes up. All of those who are disappointed in the world, include it all. All of those who left because they were disappointed in the world. So these are the ways in which they're already there. Many of our traditions, it doesn't matter. There is a way of bringing that prayer down. And then through that, after you feel that and you hear that, see if you can talk. And if you can't, what will you say? Is it what you prepared when you walked in the door? Probably not. The witnesses should continue witnessing. They haven't had the elixir. So they're going to talk maybe with what they came in with at the door. So I think, you know, meditation is not for everybody. I always tell people, please don't think you have to meditate. You know, it's getting some kind of, how would you say, a supreme practice. You know, it's not a supreme one for everyone. And it's only for those who want to dwell and want to feel into the depth of this life, even if you're not calm when you do it, even if you're traumatized when you do it, even if you need help to do it, that you will do it anyway. And that's what I have had to do. I never meant to be a Buddhist priest. Never meant to be one. Someone told me I write poetry. Okay. They still today tell me, oh, that was poetic. I go, wow, it was. You know? And to me, I'm just writing. I'm writing from the from that depth of the silence. And I'm writing from there. So it's poetic. You know, the action of that may be poetic, you know. So I actually, you know, you invited me to, if I wanted to read a piece. And I think what I just said fits what I might want to share with you. So from the deepest piece, I'm sharing the section called Poetic Solitude, the Poetic Justice of Phyllis Wheatley, who was a slave as a child and still walked through the gateway of poetry. Mm-hmm. So powerful. So I wrote, candlelight accompanies the silence. Sitting at the desk in the spirit of Phyllis Wheatley, my poetry has a ride for the evening. I'm excited for such justice for what I've endured. My fingers move fast. I try to settle down with deep breathing. A slow rhythm must be used in the transfer of words from their arrival from silence and their departure back into silence. These are moments that are slow but ruthless, raw, and unintentional. I'm sitting still. I write to hear. What is there to hear in the midst of destruction? What is there to know about the nature of living on the edge? A silent justice speaks. Its message rises through the moment of birds, the running of water, the moonlight on barren land. Justice is open, empty space, and time to gather a fresh collective song. The silence is doing everything. I'm not making the silence. Poetic action is coming from the depth of the earth. Writing is poetic action. Words go back into the silence once they are written, heard, or read. To cling to them leaves little space and time for the new message, the new witnessing, the new poetic solitude and action? Which way does the water flow after the storm? Despite struggles, I chop the onions, garlic, and mince the ginger, saute, mix with the boiled and peeled sesame sweet potatoes, puree with boiled water, scented and flavored with lemongrass. There's nothing to do but let the meeting of the senses happen. Watch and listen. That is our collective action. That is our collective healing. That alone can be just a ceremony that can be done every day, every moment. Nothing elaborate. So I offer that as a way.
Beautiful, beautiful. Maybe just because you brought it up now, like a short side trail, because that's something that I think it's very deep that you said, is that there is this, the deep silence is a birthplace of the creativity that arises for you in poetry, for somebody else's drawing or any kind of whatever innovation. Mm-hmm. And if people come to you that would, you know, come from a place where they say, yes, it's amazing, but I don't feel the place of silence in myself. I feel too consumed by my life and too entangled. Like, what if any of our listeners, you know, like want to access that place of deeper silence? Is there anything you want to speak to?
Yeah, sure. It's interesting you bring that up because just this morning I was listening to a podcast and a person who is a spiritual person, I think a Christian minister. She was talking about contemplation and meditation and taking time to be silent was a luxury and a privileged place, and that everyone is too busy to do these things, trying to survive, you know, take care of the children, go to work, you know, or deal with whatever is happening in their country. Maybe their country's under siege and all these kinds of things are going on. And, you know, I was listening to her and taking that in, feeling, yes, for me, I was very privileged to be able to just stop my life and go into the monastery, although I suffered and my partner suffered too financially and in different ways we suffered because of it. I did begin to learn how not taking a whole lot of time away necessarily or leaving, you know, necessarily. But once I got a training in how to walk with the sacredness that came up from being in the monastery in the meditation, that I could walk with it. It didn't matter if I were in a post office and everybody was going crazy because the line had 100 people and one person, you know, giving out stamps or whatever, you know. It's not so much that way anymore. But I remember literally standing and everyone was yelling and screaming and they were trying to get me involved in arguing about the post office and how the post office doesn't have enough people and the people they have, they don't pay. And it was going on and on. And I was being a witness to that. And I was participating in it because I was definitely, you know, giving a nod and affirming their feelings, you know, and knowing that feeling was going on inside of me too. But I wasn't willing to join the aspect of agitation. I was only willing to hear and know it and feel it because I was feeling it too and they were speaking my feelings. I stayed with this sense of I'm in the middle of a moment of life. And some people are going crazy. Some people have yet to even arrive to this craziness that's happening right now. And people were starting to come in the door. So I think that if we wait for our lives to be not busy or to not have chaos or disruption, to learn how to hone and harvest silence, then I think that's how we feel sometimes. All of life has gone by and now I'm dying. So to take the time, you don't have to go to a monastery or a retreat center either, any of these things, but to take the time. And I think I have been doing that since I think that childhood story I told you, the child who died, I had to take the time, even as a little girl, at 6 years old, to stop with the sobering reality that I was going to die. And I could die next week. I didn't have to grow up and die. I thought I had to grow up, at least get old. But that wasn't true. So I offer to students or aspirants who come to me to just start with the moments. That's the way I did. That grew into 5 minutes. That grew into 10. I try my best not to have long sittings for people, you know, because it's, if they don't understand what they're doing, and they're not coming to me to find out more, then that can be traumatizing. Sitting can be very traumatizing. Silence can be traumatizing. You know, we're talking trauma. And so we have to take in only what we can handle. I only took in what I can handle. So yes, now I can sit every day. If I went to a monastery or went to, say, an intensive retreat or a long one, I can sit every day for 8 hours, you know, walking and breaks, 8 hours every day. But that started with moment by moment. So, you know, that must have taken many, many years. But some people start there. Oh, I'm just going to jump in and do 8 hours every day, you know, and it's just not recommended from me as a teacher. I think some people do. They, you know, go on and struggle and suffer. And I just don't like to see people suffer like that. And there's different ways, you know. Walking, some people may need to walk first, do the walking meditation first. So while some people who hone the sitting, let the others hone the walking. And somebody can hone the lying down, and somebody can hone the standing. I mean, there's just so many ways. A lot of my stillness came from drumming. Now, is drumming still? I'm a drummer. I drum Congolese rhythms. Not too still, not too quiet. But the arrival of what comes after the last beat, that arrival to that space, that silence is so full of the power of the earth after the rhythm. So one person came to me and she said, well, there's no drumming in Zen. I said, oh, but there's rhythm. Plenty of rhythm, plenty of chanting, and there is drumming. But, you know, maybe she didn't hear it that day or that week. There is drumming. There's a wooden drum, so it's not the drum you think it is. It's just a different place. But there is rhythm, and rhythm is very important. It's in every single tradition. I don't know a tradition without rhythm. Without a way of bringing rhythm into the movement. That's why I love the spontaneous poetry that comes up in social justice movements. The rhythm just comes right up. Even when there's a protest and they're shouting, I hear the poetry. I hear the rhythm. I love it. I love it. I just, you know, even though those places turn sometimes out to be unsafe, but there's kind of this natural inclination to go toward the rhythm, no matter where we are, where we're going. And we know that it does something for us. We know that it picks us up here and drops us off there. We know that, you know. So does jazz have rhythm? You bet. Even if it's the quiet Miles Davis, it's just a long note, but there's a rhythm in that long note. There's a rhythm in it. So I think it's really important to take the time, whether you're busy or not, and not wait till you're sick and then, oh, I'm not busy. I'm sick though now. Or wait till a vacation time or all of these things. Just have a moment every day, even if it's short, you know, because that wasn't 45 minutes. That was only two. Have one good solid minute of just stopping. Let's call it stopping, not meditation, just stop. And what do you hear? Children screaming in the playground, birds singing, you know, gunshots. What do you hear? And how is what you hear impacting you and the collective around you? Not with words, just feeling it, using your body for that. And then you can go back to busy. Yeah. If you want. But I would bet busy will go away. Uh-huh. Little by little. Uh-huh. You know. Until you become a spiritual teacher, then you get busy.
Right.
That's pretty cool.
What I also love when I listen to you is to participate in when, for example, when you describe the listening to the rhythm, it's also that the listening changes, you know, with the practice, also what you hear, like with how you listen changes, and the depth of deeper aspects of rhythm in life or deeper patterns in life become more apparent. Mm-hmm. You know, that the internal state that changes also the world that we perceive or are able to perceive, or the subtleties of the world. And when I listen to you, like I got a sense of like the deeper listening, like listening has depth and different levels of depth. And that was beautiful to participate in when you shared about it.
Yeah.
And one thing that I think that you started us off with that contributes to depth, and you spoke periodically about it, is like to hear the drumbeat of the planet. Uh-huh. And I think in one way you spoke about it in your initial invocation. When we honor the lineage, and you know, and a lot of trauma and collective trauma is built on ancestral trauma that has been passed on and created cyclic patterns in family streams and mm-hmm. cultures. And maybe you can speak a little bit from your experience, like how the honoring of the ancestry and our ancestors and also lineages, like you spoke about them, uh-huh. the sages and the saints of the tradition. And I think it's very powerful to be able to honor and bow down to the greatness of the ones that came before us. Uh-huh. So maybe you can speak a little bit about how that creates depth. Because I think that's uh-huh. like at the base of depth. So maybe you can speak a little bit to the uh-huh. honoring the lineages uh-huh. and healing the lineages.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, from the first human, they are begging us to do the healing. the first human. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily feel that I don't feel any ancestors. I hear people say that. I don't feel anything. I don't know what you're talking about. And then they sit there and tell me their trauma and their suffering. And I go, it's right there. It's right there. You're not new to it. You're not new to it. It's not new to humanity. What I suffer as a person of African descent is older than I can ever imagine. It's far beyond anybody that I can bring up. But I do know the ascension, and that ascension is the death. In that ascension of the dying and the going away and then coming into this pure consciousness of wisdom that I think happens for everyone, even if that wisdom is just who they leave behind, maybe it's not even them, it's who they leave behind, what they leave with us, and the wisdom and the light and the consciousness, that is within us. And it's illuminating through the ancestors, illuminated as they leave. It's just illuminated back and reflected back. We are the same people that was before. We're the same. We're embodied differently. We have different conditions to live under, but we're those same people with the same human conditions and the same human consciousness, thank goodness. So which one, the conditions or the consciousness or the wisdom are we holding, you know, for the healing? And so we might not be able to say, well, I'm going to heal what happened to Africans who were stolen and enslaved. I'm going to heal that. I don't have to go back and say that I'm going to heal that. But I can stop and say, I feel that same and know that same pain and know that same suffering. I wasn't enslaved, but I was. But here I am I've been brought forth from that place, even before they were enslaved. I've been brought forth from that place to here, you know, to now. And, the conditions of human beings are from that place, from when they were human beings, is here now too. The trauma, all of it's here now. So then how am I to hold this? I to think that I can do it. I'll do this. I am going to end this right now for us. I remember trying to end something in my own family that was happening with the women. You know, it was some kind of, to me, similar abuses were happening to us. And I'm like, well, I hope this ends, you know, but it didn't mean, you know, I need to go like, let me tell you, you're doing the same thing mama did. I didn't need to do that. All I did was put the intention out and said that I wanted this to end. Now, whether it was going to end in my lifetime in the way I want it, I don't know. And I think that that's what we get caught up in. We get caught up in that we can do it and we're going to do it. And in that process, we get all, you know, sucked up. You know, we jump into the bowl of soup and we're like, oh no. And so, you know, it's not us that is doing it, but I trust that myself, that it's not us. And that what we're bringing with us is not only the trauma, we're bringing the wisdom and the consciousness. We're bringing that right in our makeup, you know, in our DNA. And if we want to know who was there long ago, well, I see your grandfather. I see your great, 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 great grandma. I know exactly how he looks. I see your great grandmother. Right? You can see mine. We can, they're still looking at each other. through us.
Exactly.
It was so powerful that can happen, that the life and the light of the life, the source of the light, is just right here. There is a source of light. That's why when I say way, way back there, where the source of life is, we're not the same because we're human. You know, a lot of people say, well, we're all the same. We're not the same because we're human. We're the same because we're from the same source of light and life. There was a source of life that brought us. And each one keeps bringing that life forward, 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 forever. And what we do here may not be for us here in 2021. And I was told this by a teacher. It's for maybe 30, 31. And I was very disappointed. I want my hard work to, I want to see the results now. I want to see the world change now. I want to see what I want now. Because I don't know if I'll be here or I'll be able to see, and I don't. You know, but someone of me will. Someone of me will. Not my, doesn't have to be my child. Someone of me is still coming. Or it's here. Could be in my little niece, my nephew, or all the children I've taken care of, could have been any of them. So I think that if we start to take action in a way that we are doing it, I think that's when we get into trouble. I think it gets, we start reifying our trauma because we can't do it. I'm going to tell you, we cannot do that. But I remember asking Abbott, you know, they have this ceremony called Shosan, and you stand up and you ask the Abbott a question, you know. And some people were asking questions, you know, they had read some books, I could tell, you know, very abstract Zen questions. And I got up and said, you know, I feel very wounded. Is it possible I will always feel this way? And he looked in my eyes and said, yes. And I put my hands together and I said, thank you. And you back away and then you bow some more bows back there, you know, not to him, not bowing to him, bowing to the words that came from the silence, from the way, way back, from the source of light that came through that person to me. That to me was the voice of somewhere else. It didn't say that I would die of the woundedness, that I would have a horrible life because of it. But that it would be there. And because it's there, that's when I realized that disruption is there. Woundedness is part of life. Destruction is part of life. Trauma is part of life. Then what am I to do? What am I to do? And I ask my students, how can you use racism? So we have a pact. We're an all black Zen Sangha. We're all black Zen. And that's very rare. So there's a pact, you can't talk about white people. So of course the first part is beginning of our conversations, we didn't have any. Because I go, nope. Because we're not talking about blackness juxtaposed to whiteness. We're talking about blackness. And we do know there's an integration, but we're talking about you and the evolution of that blackness in you and what it is. So I still get analysis. So if I ask, if somebody analysis, they have great analysis of whiteness. And then I ask, can you give me the same for blackness? What's the analysis for blackness? You're spending too much time out there. It doesn't matter if white, brown, there's any kind of, just anything out there. Because if you're out there, I know for myself, when I did that, I was re-traumatized every time I did the analysis. Exactly. And then when I took this trauma into, in this woundedness into ceremony, because even when the teacher said, no, it's still there, and I went like this, something happened right there. Something happened to me. Not only to me, to some people who were in the room, because they came to me later in tears. It was their thing. I didn't get engaged with it, but it was interesting to see a simple question, a simple bow, and be touched to the point that something changed for us, not the woundedness, but something changed in how we would walk with that woundedness, because we were going to stay alive, wounded or not. So that means we had to walk, not for the rest of our lives, but walk out of that Buddha hall into the hallway with that woundedness. Just one step. Let me just talk on one step.
Amazing. It's so beautiful. So lovely. It's very deep what you shared with us. Very deep.
Maybe I'll share some more poetry. This is, in the deepest peace, rattling the bones, my ancient stories. The first breath of a spring day is surrounded by orchids in my room. Tension is hunted down in the body, then breathed out. Bones are let down from being folded up overnight. Deep breathing releases the dark river that pumps inside my body. This river can't be heard, but speaks when clogged. These bones can't be heard, but rattle when I remember, when I dig into an ancient story. The moment just passed is ancient. I remember it. My bones rattle. When still, I sense the bones of the earth, the bones of those who crawled upon the earth or flew above clouds are the same bones inside of me. The same bones hold the same wisdom. Bare bones let us know life is impermanent. You don't have to believe Buddha. Accepting the passing of life brings the presence of peace.
Thank you very much, Benju. This was really amazing, amazing ride. There are all kinds of dimensions together. Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you so much. It was a great enrichment for the summit. Also, I enjoyed deeply your depth and the innocence and the openness of your curiosity, and the depth that you're exploring. It's beautiful. So thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
Visit CollectiveTraumaSummit.com to listen to more talks like this one and to sign up and be the first to know when the next Collective Trauma Summit is announced. Thanks for listening to Point of Relation with Thomas Hubel. Stay connected by visiting our website, pointofrelationpodcast.com, and by subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a positive rating and review, and share about us with your community on social media. Thank you. We appreciate your support.